Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Since President Trump took office in January, the way we interact with our neighbors has certainly changed, especially in South America. Since the start of September, the Trump administration has authorized more than 20 strikes on boats in the Caribbean Sea, claiming they were ferrying drugs. With many of these boats hailing from Venezuela, this is just one of many escalations between Venezuela and the United States over the last few months. Recently, Trump hinted at closing the airspace above Venezuela and designated one of its biggest cartels as a terrorist organization. So what is the future for Venezuela and the United States, and what does the average American need to worry about? Joining us now is Will Friedman, Fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hi, good morning.
So what exactly are the Trump administration's demands for Venezuela? What does the United States, via the Trump administration, want to see from Venezuela right now?
It hasn't been too clearly articulated, but I think we're hearing in a scattershot fashion a mix of demands. So one have been repeated kind of insinuations that Maduro can't continue as the authoritarian president, as the dictator of Venezuela, that he must leave office. But it's interesting that Trump himself has often then come short of exactly saying that in such clear language, or he's even said sometimes, we're not talking about regime change. So I leave it to you and the listeners to decide what to make of that. But we're hearing some insinuations in that direction. You know, probably the most consistent claim of the administration is that the Venezuelan regime is a narco-terrorist organization that is flooding the U.S. with drugs. So just to break that down, I mean, about 8% of the cocaine that enters the U.S. comes through Venezuela, maybe upwards close to 15. Of course, most of it's coming through Mexico, really the lion's share. And none of the fentanyl entering the U.S. comes through Venezuela. No one has ever found that in the U.S. government, in the intelligence agencies, in the press. Literally none. So the other claim or the other demand is that the Venezuelan regime crack down on drug trafficking. How much of an effect will that really have on drug inflows into the U.S., on drug overdose deaths? You know, probably pretty minimal, but that's the other demand. And then I think the third one, which we're not hearing in public as much, but which I would guess is very close to the priorities of this administration, is that they want some kind of deal on migration. Now, currently, Venezuela takes back two packed flights of deportees every single week. That's actually continued even as you've seen these escalating threats might be up in the air now with a closed airspace. But I think they're probably, you know, Stephen Miller, others around the president are looking for some kind of compacts on migration, you know, either preventing more Venezuelans from leaving in the future, taking back even larger numbers now. But I have to imagine that that's on the table. But, you know, I just want to take a step back here and say it's a bit strange that we as the American public, we're potentially about to go to war. We haven't even been given a clear accounting of the reasons. I mean, when we went to war with Iraq, there was a story about why we were doing it. It didn't necessarily, you know, it actually turned out to be mostly false, but there was a story put out there. The Bush administration gave us a clear set of reasons that they believed it was necessary. Right now, it's almost like I'm, you know, trying to throw darts at a dartboard blindfolded and explain to you why we're on the precipice of this conflict.
Yeah. When I was doing research for the show, I found a couple of headlines that said we were on the brink of World War III. And it kind of, you know, and I know that that's just a headline grabber to get me to click on it. But I didn't know it was that close. I the idea of talking about our relationship with Venezuela, World War III did not come to mind. Should it?
No, I don't think it should. No, not at all. And, you know, some people, I think for self-interested reasons, often there's kind of a cohort of national security professionals, ex-national security professionals who really amp up this idea that Venezuela is like a critical ally to Russia, China, Iran. And look, it is an ally, but the idea that they would be willing to escalate or risk a major confrontation with the U.S. over Venezuela is laughable. Okay, they've been sending all the signals over the last few weeks. They are going to abandon Maduro. Venezuela barely loans any money. China barely loans any money to Venezuela anymore. You know, Russia has an air defense system there and a handful of military advisors, but it's not critical to them. It's not geostrategically that important. And as something I imagine we might discuss is the oil, because many people think, well, Venezuela's got the largest proven reserves of oil. That means that it's geopolitically important to everyone. But you know, we're in a very different world than we were 2 decades ago. The U.S. is the world's largest energy exporter. Brazil, Colombia, other countries in the region are exporting far more oil than Venezuela. So those reserves are no longer as necessarily as strategic as they once were either. It just makes Venezuela less important than it once was, and it raises a question again: why are we escalating there? Why are we focusing so much energy there, as we have under Biden, under Obama, under Trump one? Why this preoccupation with Venezuela when again it's Mexico and the dysfunction there that's causing, you know, the tens of thousands of overdose deaths in our country?
Well, let's lean into President Maduro for a moment, because just as recently as this morning in the New York Times, there was an article saying, and it basically alluded to the fact that Maduro is going to just, his plan is to outlast President Trump. I mean, he's younger than him, and he's having parties and giving speeches every day and just really doing like a public blitz. What is your take on him and how the Venezuelan people view him?
You know, the tough part here is that even the high quality reporting coming out on this, of course, it's just using anonymous sources, because anyone with real insider information or knowledge of either the military or the civilian part of the regime in Venezuela, they're terrified to speak. I mean, they would face immediate retaliation if they went public with their comments. So we don't really know who's speaking, how much information they have. Some people are saying Maduro and his inner circle are more worried than ever. Some people are saying that they kind of already understand this as a bluff and they're not too concerned. I know it's not such a satisfactory answer, but I think we really don't know. That's the nature of an authoritarian regime. It's quite opaque. I think what we've most recently heard is that there was this phone call between Trump and Maduro, and ostensibly Maduro demand yeah Trump said, "We'll offer you and your family safe passage out of the country." Maduro said, "No, I want something more. I want blanket amnesty for me and, you know, the highest ranking officials wherever we go in the world." And of course, there's an international criminal court investigation against Maduro for human rights crimes. And Trump said no. So the fact that Maduro was willing to articulate a counter demand and then let this negotiation drop, presumably, I think it probably suggests that he's feeling more or less confident. He may be afraid, but look, this is a guy who doesn't necessarily see a future for himself outside of power. He may not even see guarantees for his own life. So I think he would need an exceptional degree of assurances to leave office, which really no one can provide in this situation. And so for that reason, he's decided, you know, I'm going to cling on to power, and if need be, go down with the ship.
And the State Department recently designated Cartel de las Soles a terrorist organization. So it also said that Maduro, the State Department identifies Maduro as a leader of the cartel. So what significance does this have related to the relationship? Because, you know, there's that whole other part that you mentioned about Venezuela flooding the U.S. with drugs. So what does it mean for the United States to say the president is the leader of a cartel?
Well, so first, I think there's a grain of truth here, a pretty large sized grain, which is that Venezuela is a mafia state. So since we've started sanctioning their economy under the first Trump administration, and even before that, the regime in Venezuela, in order to pay off its cronies and keep their loyalties intact, keep them from defecting to the opposition, they've made a systematic practice of letting state officials run illegal gold mining, which is actually more profitable in Venezuela than drugs, most likely. Also, cocaine trafficking, human smuggling, a whole range of rackets are under the control of the authoritarian state. And of course, Nicolas Maduro is the leader of that state. So is he tolerating it? Absolutely. And is he even organizing it at some level? It's plausible, right? But it's a bit of a jump from there to say that he is the leader of a cartel. So I just want to make that distinction. I mean, the quote unquote cartels, these multinational criminal businesses in Colombia, Venezuela, excuse me, Colombia, Brazil, Mexico. I mean, we're talking about essentially illegal private businesses that have representatives, that have members in often over 20 countries. That's not what the government of Venezuela is. It's a mafia state, but it's not the same type of organization. It doesn't necessarily have the same logistical capacity. It's not as skilled as a business. It's kind of doing something more rudimentary. Finally, it's again bringing about 8 to maybe 10% of the cocaine that the U.S. consumes into the country, mostly by way of Trinidad and Tobago and then Puerto Rico. But it is not responsible for the fentanyl epidemic, any way you slice it. So the idea that we're saving 20,000 American lives, I think the president said, each time that a drug boat is blown up, drug boats that, if they are carrying drugs, they're almost certainly carrying cocaine. It's just completely detached from reality.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the United States and its relationship with Venezuela with Will Freeman, fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Over the weekend, President Trump said that Venezuelan airspace should be considered closed to all airlines and pilots. So what does this mean? Is it a sign of clear escalation, or like, what does it mean to have a president close airspace?
Yeah, so I mean, one, he gave the order over Truth Social, not via the Pentagon, so it's kind of clear, unclear, you know, how serious it was. And then he told a reporter, "Don't read too much into it." So,
Oh, okay.
what to make of that? I have no idea. I mean, what we have seen from flight trackers is that the skies are largely empty over Venezuela. So I think most, you know, airlines are taking this as a taking the precaution of not flying. And it is serious to, even in this very informal and sort of contradictory way, to put that messaging out there. Of course, it's serious. Trump has also just in the past few days reiterated a claim that the administration is about to commit engage in land strikes. Against what? We don't really know. There's been contradictory reporting again from anonymous sources, Miami Herald, New York Times, I believe. Wall Street Journal, all, you know, saying different things, but could this be military bases? Again, under the logic that the military is involved in drug trafficking, that could be, you know, could it be a sort of insurgent camp in the near the Colombian border? But I think we probably do see some strike on land. I don't think that that forces Maduro overnight to flee or leave power. But it does seem that, you know, this is an escalation, no doubt. Even if, again, it's being conveyed in this sort of confusing way where you're almost sometimes thinking, well, it sounds like Trump himself is asking people to not take his threat so seriously.
Well, what about other countries with the airspace? Is it just United States related planes and pilots who are not supposed to fly over it, or do
Oh,
other countries follow
no. It's
suit? Okay.
the signal seems to have been pretty broadly interpreted. So it's actually, you know, other South Latin American countries are. And European countries are probably most of the flights. The United States doesn't have too many commercial flights left. Last I checked, I think that some deportation flights had actually been interrupted. And that to me does seem significant because as long as the deportation flights are going to Caracas, you know, someone in the Maduro government, someone in the Trump administration are on the phone working that out. So as long as that's been going, I've treated this all as kind of a bluff. And as long as Chevron continues having a license to pump oil. So that's actually happening right now. I mean, Chevron is pumping oil in Venezuela as all this is going on. As long as there's been the Chevron continuing to pump and the deportation flights, it's just not seemed that's terribly significant to me. But we'll see. If those things change, then I think it's a sign that, okay, something's really heating up here.
Now, South America is big, lots of countries involved. What do you think other countries make of, President Trump and Maduro and this relationship between the U.S. and Venezuela and these escalations? Are the other countries trying to stay out of it?
You know, it's been a mix. You have only one country, Trinidad and Tobago, so, you know, small couple islands right off the coast of Venezuela, which has actually been pretty vocally supportive of a U.S. military intervention. You've had, you know, one, Colombia, whose government is every day denouncing this, but most are in the middle. They're just trying to stay quiet. I think not tr try not to get on Trump's bad side. Because they know how quickly a tariff might pop up. And they also don't want to get on the bad side of their own populations. And here's something interesting, which is that credible recent polling shows that a US military intervention in Venezuela is more popular in South America than it is in the United States itself, by quite a wide margin. And in some countries, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, it's well over a majority of the population that supports or would support a US military intervention. Why? I mean, these are countries that have received millions of Venezuelan migrants and refugees in recent years. They do not have the economies like ours that can actually absorb large influxes of people fairly well. They don't have you know, the police forces to handle any crime that comes with it as well. So, you know, they've really been strained. They've been strained. There's a rising xenophobia. There are politicians in those countries talking about sending Venezuelans back. And so I think a lot of voters, a lot of less ideological voters in those countries are saying, we just want someone to fix the problem. And it sounds like getting Maduro out of the power is the you know, the out of power is the problem. Trump's seeming to offer a story about how to do that. For people in the U.S., it's a much more distant concern. I mean, here about 500,000 Venezuelans have arrived in the last decade. Compare that to 1.5 million, almost 2 million in Colombia, 1 million in Peru. And again, these are smaller countries. So I think for us, it feels less relevant, or at least most of the country, maybe put South Florida aside. But for Latin America, especially the neighboring countries, this is a really it's been a major problem. And so most leaders, I think, are taking all that into account, and they're waiting and seeing what happens.
Staying with us after the break is Will Freeman, fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And coming up, we're going to talk about another country making news for its relationship with President Trump, Argentina. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The relationship between President Trump and Argentina's president, Javier Milei, has been close-knit even before Trump was inaugurated in January. With similar ideologies and communities, the two leaders seem to have a beneficial relationship, leading the Trump administration to initiate a multi-billion dollar bailout for Argentina. So how did Argentina end up in this position, and what might the United States get in exchange for this so-called bailout? What is the future of the United States and Argentina relations? Still with us is Will Freeman, fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for staying with us, Will.
My pleasure.
And also joining us now is Kevin Sullivan, Vice President of the Washington Office of America Society, Council of the Americas, and former U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Kevin, let's start with you. Since Trump was inaugurated in January, and even during his time on the campaign trail, he was very friendly with the president of Argentina. How did that relationship start? They just like each other?
Well, I think there's a lot of affinity there in terms of the styles of the two leaders. Kind of like President Trump, Javier Milei was always a kind of transgressive leader. He spoke in very dramatic terms, and he represented a real break with the status quo. Also, he's of course very conservative, and made a great show of his plans to cut the budget in Argentina, the federal budget, with a chainsaw. And that kind of imagery and style really seemed to appeal to President Trump, also to Elon Musk, who's visited with Milei a number of times, and really has resonated to an impressive degree with President Trump's political base as well. So I think that's how things developed organically, and the two leaders do seem to like spending time together.
And moving on to what I mentioned about the money. So the U.S. Treasury Secretary originally authorized a $20 billion infusion through a currency swap with Argentina. Now, I am reading here and there that 20 billion number might change. But Kevin, can you tell me what is a currency swap exactly? And is it a bailout?
So the currency swap is intended to address what has been kind of the Achilles heel of President Milei's very ambitious economic reform program. You know, he has indeed cut the budget dramatically there, and which is a good thing by most people's estimation, because Argentina's recurring crises over the year have been driven by kind of chronic deficits and succeeding financial crises. While his plan has reduced the budget deficit, and it's also cut inflation very significantly there, which is what Milei was elected to do, the IMF has pointed out that the Milei's macroeconomic approach has proceeded with a base of very limited currency reserves in the central bank. And so as the elections were approaching last year, midterm elections in Argentina, the Argentine peso was coming under a lot of pressure. That's to say, speculators were betting that it would depreciate dramatically versus the dollar. So the currency swap that Scott Bessent, our Treasury Secretary, organized basically helped convince speculators that Argentina would have the macroeconomic ammunition to defend its exchange rate. And in that sense, it was very successful. First of all, Milei and his coalition did better than expected in the midterm elections and so got themselves a new political mandate. And, you know, although the jury is still out over the medium and long term, the currency has stabilized since the election. So it could be that the actual cost to the U.S. taxpayer is quite limited at the end of the day.
Will Freeman, let's bring you back in here. So we just spent a lot of time talking about how the average American might not understand what's going on in Venezuela. But I think the average American caught the headline of giving $20 billion to Argentina. So so what do you make of this currency swap and how the average American would see, you know, President Trump giving all this money to Argentina?
Right. Well, I think there's a due amount of confusion and skepticism because I thought this was the government of America first. So I'm from Minnesota. There's a lot of soy farmers there, right? A lot of soy farmers in Iowa. Why are we propping up a country literally on the other side of the globe, right? Regardless of the merits of its current economic policy and president, why are we propping up a country that's not important to migration, doesn't really matter for counter-narcotics? Interesting, great place, but it's just not core to U.S. national security interests. For some reason, we decided that that's the best use of that money, the biggest bailout of its kind since the mid-1990s when we saved Mexico's economy. I mean, one that's much more critical to us. And then meanwhile, right, this is a country that competes with us. It's a country that's selling large amounts of soy to China. So our farmers are directly, you know, hurt as a result. I think there's one clear reason. It's about ideology, right? It's because Milei is ideologically aligned with the president. He also happens to be a sycophantic character. This is an administration that wants to see the region governed by like-minded administrations. It also explains why we're seeing such intense interest in Honduras. I mean, a really tiny economy. Yeah, it matters more for migration, but by no means a geopolitically important country in a significant sense. And yet you're seeing the president tweet about it, you know, an essay-length social media post delving into the nuances of different candidates. The only explanation I can see for it is that they want this ideological alignment. I really think that's what's driving it. I think that that's what motivated the bailout of Argentina. And I want to separate that from saying, you know, I actually do think President Milei has done some good things in Argentina. I think the economy is moving in a better direction, certainly than it was under the party that preceded him, which was quite corrupt, economically a disaster. You know, is this the best use of our resources? Is there a way to really justify it to the American public? I think it's a difficult case to make, just like it's a difficult case to make why we should be doing regime change in Venezuela.
Yeah, Kevin, what's your take on that? Do you feel that the United States is overstepping a little bit here in Argentina, you know, just based on the money and our interest with the country?
You know, I agree with Will that at the moment, particularly that President Trump undertook to organize this rescue package for Argentina, the U.S. government was shut down and there had been a lot of cuts to important programs here in the U.S. So certainly it's easy to see why a lot of constituencies in the U.S. would wonder why we would take something like this on. You know, my only, I think, difference with Will would be that I think Argentina does have some strategic importance. It's true that they are not an important factor in migration or in drug trafficking, but it is a country that is rich with minerals. I know a lot of U.S. firms are quite interested in investing in Argentina and are doing so. And Argentina can supply much more in terms of critical minerals than they have done so far. It's really a great opportunity, and it's a place where China has been very active. In fact, in the past, China has supplied currency swaps to previous Argentine governments when they were in difficulty. So the U.S. government stepping up at this time, I think many people would see as part of the geopolitical competition with China. And arguably, you could say the same about Honduras, although it's a very different country and different situation. But Honduras switched its recognition from Taiwan to China just a couple of years ago under the outgoing government. And one of the candidates running in the election in Honduras would represent really continuity with the current government. So we don't know who will come out on top in Honduras yet, but it seems that it will be one of the two conservative or more conservative candidates who might be more likely to align policies with the U.S. in terms of strategic competition with China. But I do agree with Will that the ideological lens is important, but also I think the strategic competition with China is a big factor in some of these actions.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the United States and its relationship with Argentina with Kevin Sullivan, Vice President of the Washington Office of America Society and former U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua, and also Will Freeman, Fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Will, in mid-October, there was a press conference, and President Trump said, if he doesn't win, we're gone. That's referring to Milei and the United States with the financial support of Argentina. So this really is a relationship between the two of them. Like, if someone else would have won, we would not have done the $20 billion, do you think, Will?
Well, these were not presidential elections, which...
you're
entirely... it makes complete sense why you thought that, because each time President Trump talked about it, he seemed to be talking about Milei personally winning. And I know that can be a euphemism from, okay, your party wins. But
I see. Okay.
Just to be clear, these were legislative. They were kind of like midterms, so they were more of a temperature check on how Milei was doing, how much continuity would his project have, would he have the numbers in the legislature to pass key economic reforms, because he came in as quite the outsider, as the ambassador mentioned. And Ambassador, great to be here with you. Yeah, I mean, I think that probably we would, had Milei not performed well, I think he would have fallen a bit in Trump's estimation. I don't think we would see such continued interest or engagement in the country. But it depends. And I, just going back to one question on the China competition here, I completely agree with the ambassador that that is a factor. And we saw very early on in this administration a focus on Panama, where publicly the framing there was we need to wrest back influence from China, especially around the canal. And so I think that matters. But one thing I didn't see ever publicly confirmed was what exactly the United States asked Argentina for vis-a-vis China. So did we get any hard and fast commitments from Argentina to, in any important way, move away from China? I know in certain defense areas, purchasing defense equipment, they have already, since Milei's beginning of his term, moved towards the United States. And I'm sure that's encouraging, but did they make any big commitments here? And I ask that because, you've seen structurally over the last two decades, all the big economies in South America, save Colombia's, have all become reliant on exporting raw materials to China. That's how their economies work now. That's their engine, their motor. And they can't necessarily flip that off, even if they've wanted to. So we've seen one conservative president after the other come into office in South America, promising to have a much more U.S.-aligned policy. But in the end of the day, they're still they have to face facts that their economies run on supplying China. That's been the case of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, is the case of Ivan Duque in Colombia. I think it's the case of Milei. I mean, he used to talk about the Chinese Communist Party as murderers with whom he couldn't do business. Now he's, much more of a pragmatist. So I just haven't seen from the Trump administration whether they think they can change that balance of economic power. Do they want to? Are they just playing for influence in other spaces, for instance, and in terms of incentivizing or getting concessions for mineral investment? Let's see.
Yeah. Kevin, what do you make of the Argentina-China relationship and what's going to come of it? Because I feel like the $20 billion happened, and maybe is President Trump biding his time and he's going to be asking for something in the future? Milei will owe him one.
Well, I think there's a lot of trust in that relationship, and trust is so important. I think that, certainly the U.S. government will be looking to see how Argentina positions itself vis-a-vis China on a lot of issues, from what kinds of investments it encourages or allows, to how Argentina positions itself on global issues like the G20 or Gaza, et cetera. So Argentina has become an important ally for the U.S. on the global stage diplomatically. So I think that is one benefit that the Trump administration has gotten out of this relationship. And certainly you see the Milei government working much harder to promote investment from the U.S. and other Western firms than they do promoting investment from China. Having said that, Will is exactly right that Argentina continues to sell its products, particularly commodities, to China, just as the rest of South American countries do, because China is the natural market for them. It's huge, and China has a need for that. Whereas, as Will also said, the U.S. is a producer of a lot of those economies, so we don't really need Argentina to sell their wheat or soybeans to us. So I think the relationship does make sense and does bring benefits to the Trump administration. And I think in many ways they see the kind of dynamic they have with Milei as kind of something they're modeling for the rest of the hemisphere. Wouldn't you like a relationship like this with the U.S. president? Do you see what President Milei is getting out of this? So it is sending a signal to others that I think the U.S. administration views as quite valuable.
And Will, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about this idea of where the United States is setting its priorities, because it's hard to be involved in every country in all of the world. There's a lot of headlines about Russia and Ukraine, there's Gaza, and now we spent all this time talking about Venezuela and Argentina, but you've mentioned Panama and Honduras. Can the United States be involved in all of this? Do they need to be? Will, what do you think?
So I think that there are different types of involvement, right? So there's one type of involvement which says, what are our national interests? What's going to keep the American people safe and prosperous, et cetera? And you need to be involved on those issues in those places. And then there's this other type that's much more ideological, about kind of steering, I don't know, the destiny of an entire region politically. And I really think we're best off sticking to that first kind. And in fact, I think many people expected Trump to. They talked about him as a transactional president. Again, I have my questions about that. I think what we're seeing is actually a much more ideologically driven policy than necessarily a transactional deal-making based one. But so I'd say that we should be trying for that, you know, that kind of hard-headed policy where we think about really what benefits us and how can we work with our partners in the region to make it happen. And then second, I do think we need to be focused closer to home. So we can't be involved everywhere in the Western Hemisphere. I'm glad this administration is focused more on the Western Hemisphere than perhaps past ones. I actually think that's quite good. But I think we need to be thinking selectively about where. For me, there's no country more important than Mexico. Obviously, we share our massive land border. Mexico's our biggest trade partner. It's only becoming more and more important to our economy. It's the country that determines whether or not we have border security, whether or not we can control our own border depends on Mexican cooperation. And it's, of course, been the central country in terms of enabling some of the dynamics that have led to our overdose death crisis from the drug crisis. So I think that Mexico should be the focus. Now, it's a tricky, tough relationship right now. You have a very popular government in Mexico, a populist government, which in many ways doesn't see eye to eye with the White House even now, and where there's been, you know, I think, unfortunately, a really concerted effort to protect narco-related corruption inside the state itself. That's our biggest issue, if you ask me, in Mexico. It's what do we do about that? What do we do about the fact that our neighboring country, there's large parts of the government that have been infiltrated by organized crime? It's not an issue that the president of Mexico wants to touch. It's one that I hoped the Trump administration would be putting more pressure on her to do something about. Unfortunately, I think they've eased off there. For me, that's the existential, you know, that's really the critical question for us in Latin America. It's not, unfortunately, Venezuela, Cuba. They may be terrible dictatorships. I think they are. But it's what do we do about Mexico and the dysfunction there? How do we stop enabling it? Because, of course, we're the biggest supplier of guns. We're the ones who buy the drugs and create this kind of malicious market dynamics in that country that lead to so much corruption in the first place. So For me, it would be a Mexico first foreign policy, at least when we look towards Latin America.
All right. Well, it sounds like then we need to do an all Mexico show and have you back.
Thank
So this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thank you to Will Freeman, Fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you for your time today, Will.
My pleasure.
And staying with us after the break is Kevin Sullivan, Vice President of the Washington Office of America Society, Council of the Americas, and former U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua. Coming up, we're going to talk about other South American countries and their relationship with the United States. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. As one of the United States' biggest trading partners and source of immigrants, the relationship between the United States and its southern neighbors is incredibly important to both parties. But as with many countries in the 2020s, nations like Brazil, Colombia, and Chile are seeing their demographics changing and their policies altering. How are South American states changing, and is it a response to the United States' changes over the years? Still with us is Kevin Sullivan, Vice President of the Washington Office of the America Society, Council of the Americas, and former U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua. Thanks again for being here today, Kevin.
Oh, great to be with you, Amy.
So let's start with Brazil. And also what is known as BRICS, B-R-I-C-S. This is key nations. The B stands for Brazil. The others are Russia, India, China, South Africa. You know, BRICS is an intergovernmental organization, kind of like NATO. But what does it mean to the United States? Because I feel like this idea of BRICS was in the news a lot, but hasn't seen a lot of primetime discussion anymore. Can you talk to me about Brazil and BRICS, B-R-I-C-S?
Sure. BRICS is not easy to define. It is seemingly very important global organization, bringing together a number of the key global players aside from the United States. But BRICS has had some difficulties exerting much influence because, you know, a variety of reasons. One, its structure is pretty loose. But the other thing is that the members, the key initials of BRICS don't always agree on the most important things. You know, think about the differences on basic democratic principles between, say, Brazil and India on one side, both large democracies, and, you know, Russia and China on the other. And also in terms of their relationships with the United States, you know, China is part of this geopolitical competition, and so is Russia. But on the other hand, India and Brazil tend to want to have a good, at least, you know, cordial relationship with the U.S. And so it really has, in some ways, I think, underperformed as an organization. But it is a concern for a lot of U.S. policymakers because, you know, anything that's going to promote, on one hand, closer cooperation between Russia and China is a concern, as we've seen in Ukraine, and anything that might, you know, reduce the openness of Brazil and India to good relations with the U.S. also is going to be a concern.
Was BRICS originally created just to try to? Was its mission to diverge from Western-dominated institutions, maybe make the dollar not as important as it is around the world?
I think in general terms, BRICS countries wanted to create alternatives to U.S. dominance as they saw it, particularly, you know, when the U.S. was seen as more the head of a unipolar world order. I think almost everyone now has seen, you know, China's influence increase, and really the people don't think of the world in the same way as when BRICS was originally created.
Yeah, I'm thinking China would probably want the C to be first instead of the B in Brazil. They're going to redo the word, maybe.
For example.
For example.
Cribs, why not?
Crib, yeah. See, that would be an easy switch. Call it cribs. Back to Brazil, though. Brazil's president is known as Lula. How is the relationship with Brazil changed with the current president as opposed to former president?
Well, I think the relationship with Brazil got off to a very rocky start in this administration for a number of reasons. Certainly, Brazil, Lula being an iconic leftist leader in the region and the world, was not going to be a natural fit for President Trump, who, as we were discussing earlier, does see the world through an ideological frame in many cases anyway. And also, at the beginning of the Trump administration, the Brazilian government found itself tangled up with Elon Musk and some of his companies in important disputes. And Elon Musk was very active on social media denouncing the Brazilian government and its institutions. And then finally, you have the longstanding affinity between former Brazilian President Bolsonaro, who is now in jail for essentially undermining the electoral process there. And he's accused of participating in a plot to murder Lula. And President Trump, since again, a bit like Milei, Bolsonaro's campaign style and general image really was similar to President Trump's in many ways. So they got off to a very rough start, and Brazil was harder hit by some of the Trump administration's early tariff announcements than other governments. Brazil, by the way, is a huge, you know, market. It's the largest market in South America for the U.S. It's got a very sophisticated economy with industrial and technological sectors. So, and it also has, it's endowed with mineral wealth, including rare earths that are right at the center of global competition now. So it really has a lot going for it, and it is quite strategically important. And I think that over time, we've seen President Trump and his administration begin to take more account of that strategic relevance that Brazil has. And we've seen in recent weeks and months a lowering of the tensions, or lowering of the conflictive tone between the two governments. There's a meeting with President Lula and President Trump that set trade negotiations on a slightly more positive track after that. And we've also seen President Bolsonaro be imprisoned related to the charges that he's faced. And the Trump administration has not reacted as strongly to that as many might have expected before that.
We've spent most of this hour talking about Venezuela and Argentina, but you would think just by its sheer size and what it has, Brazil should be more of a focus for what's happening in the United States. Do you think that it really is back to that whole idea of the personalities, and President Trump can get along better with the president of Argentina, and so therefore more communication, therefore more news about those countries instead of Brazil?
Well, sometimes, as we know, the successful children in the family get less attention than the those that have had longstanding problems. Mm. Brazil solved its macroeconomic difficulties more than 20 years ago, and they have, you know, they've had their ups and downs, but they've been basically stable. So they don't need the kind of rescue package that the U.S. recently offered to Argentina. But I completely agree that from a strategic standpoint, both in terms of geopolitical competition, but also in terms of U.S. economic interest, Brazil is a very important market for U.S. companies. It's not a perfect market. There are some issues that U.S. companies face there from a regulatory standpoint, both in technology and in energy and food and there's a lot of good that can be done, that a lot of progress that the Trump administration can accomplish with a close relationship with Brazil and a positive negotiating dynamic.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the United States and its relationship with South America with Kevin Sullivan, Vice President of the Washington Office of the America Society and former U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua. I wanted to move into Nicaragua as the former ambassador. How is the relationship between the United States and Nicaragua right now?
Well, things with Nicaragua really are in the deep freeze between the U.S. Government and President Ortega in Nicaragua. And in fact, I think the degree of change there has been much less than in some of the other relationships we've been discussing, in the sense that President Biden also had a very difficult relationship with Nicaragua when I was ambassador there. And the reason for that is that the Nicaraguan government has engaged in very large-scale systematic repression. When I was there in 2021, Nicaragua was scheduled to host presidential elections, and rather than face real democratic competition, President Ortega jailed literally every potential competitor that he might face, and then staged truly uncompetitive elections towards the end of the year. Towards the end of my tenure in Nicaragua, we were able to negotiate the release and departure from Nicaragua of 200 political prisoners representing every sector of society that had been wrongfully jailed by the Ortega administration. I would say lately the news has mm-hmm. been that as part of an annual trade review process, President Trump has, or that the USTR has indicated that they are considering a number of punitive economic measures in response to Nicaragua's failure to implement its obligations under the Central America Dominican Republic Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA-DR, as it's commonly known, and as well as its human rights abuses. And so it is possible we will see new sanctions against Nicaragua soon.
What do you think maybe not President Ortega, but the people of Nicaragua, do they want help from the United States to get closer to having free and fair elections? Is that something the United States would want to help with?
Absolutely. I think the vast majority of Nicaraguans would like political change, and the same as Venezuelans. They are very eager for U.S. help with that. It is a very difficult situation, though, because essentially all political space in Nicaragua has been closed. And so it's difficult to see peaceful political change evolving under current circumstances. Increased economic pressure through the kinds of steps that USTR has hinted at, might tip the balance a little bit, but it's very hard to say whether that would be enough to really change the fundamental equation.
We're running out of time, but before we end, I wanted to stay in Central America for a moment and talk about the Panama Canal, because it's been in the news recently. It was important at the very beginning of the Trump administration, and it seemed like right away we were talking about the Panama Canal. Why is that so important? What do Americans need to know or care about when it comes to the Panama Canal?
Well, Panama Canal has been very important for 100 years now. It is the path between the seas. A huge percentage of global trade passes through the Panama Canal, and its orderly and transparent operation and efficient operation are of great strategic importance, not just to the U.S. government, and the U.S. military, but also to economic traffic from around the world. And so it is a key issue. The Trump administration focused on the fact that some of the ports that service the area of the canal where cargo is offloaded and unloaded as it moves through the process, were controlled by companies from Hong Kong, which is now, of course, part of China. And so the Trump administration put significant pressure on the Panamanian government to review those concessions. And in fact, there have been some negotiated deals to diminish Chinese influence since then. But the level of focus on Panama over the last several months has diminished, I think, since some of those deals were negotiated.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, and thank you for enlightening us more about South America and Central America countries. We've been talking with Kevin Sullivan, Vice President of the Washington Office of the America Society and former U.S. Ambassador to Nicaragua. Thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure. Thank you, Amy.
And you've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back at WOSU.org/allsides, subscribe to our podcast, or every episode is available in the free WOSU mobile app. You can also like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Instagram. Our handle is @AllSidesWOSU. Thanks for joining us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.